are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It's Thursday, June 14th, 2018. My name is Michael Brooks on a Michael Thursday, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Jay Cassano, investigative journalist for Sludge. On the Pentagon's top official for East Asia, led think tank founded by defense contractors and foreign governments. How a major Pentagon official whose background in arms procurements, shadowy world of think tanks, is laying the ground for a military-industrial infused push towards a potential war with China. We'll untangle that story with Jay Cassano. A New York state has filed a suit against Trump, alleging that his charity engaged in illegal conduct. Very surprising. Trump appointee compiles a loyalty list for U.S. employees at the UN. That should be important. The San Francisco has elected its first black female mayor. That's the good news. The bad news is she was supported by that city's elites. Michael Cohen is under increasing pressure as Mueller stays focused on Trump. Maybe that will really turn into something. Sarah Sanders and Raj Shah are planning. They've lasted for like 6 months or so. They're ready to get the hell out of there. And the Trump White House advertises at a Hill Jobs Fair amidst a mass job exodus. Come, get abused. And Sessions freaks out on Jared Kushner because of pardons. He hates it, according to Vanity Fair. And an Arizona legislator says there aren't enough white kids to go around in state schools. Not hiding the ball anymore. And this week, the U.S. Conference of Bishops are considering punishing Catholics who enforce Trump's quote-unquote immoral border policies. All that and much, much more on today's Majority Report. It's a freaking bro down. Matt Leck is here.
Hello.
Brendan is here. Brendan Finn.
Howdy.
A temperamental main camera is here.
A temperament is that still giving you trouble?
Yeah, it's going to be giving us trouble, but we're monitoring it and going to try to fix it.
Yeah, sorry guys, it was a bit chaotic.
We had some actual legit tech difficulties. But
we're here and we're powering ahead. This is a clip that sometimes you wonder, can I have empathy for this person? This is one of the worst people on the planet. There's literally nothing redeemable about this person. He has all of his father's sociopathy, mediocrity, general weirdness, without any of his dad's sort of like, I guess, sophomoric charm. So Don Jr., of course, I'm talking about. He was on Fox and Friends. And today is Donald Trump's birthday. He turned 72. Maybe time to take a break, right, dude? But he turned 72. And of course, the best way to send your dad a happy birthday message when your dad won't see or interact with you because you're a relentless disappointment to him and not like his, you know, extremely favorite child, his daughter, his extra favorite child, is you go on your dad's favorite TV show, which he spends more time with than he does with you. Camera flashed, clicked again. To wish his dad a happy birthday. And this video at least in my interpretation, really has all the trappings of like, oh, I think this guy might have been like really seriously abused growing up. Here's Don Jr. on Fox and Friends.
Happy birthday, Dad. I love you very much. You're getting absolutely no presents because I figured 5 grandchildren is enough. And when you get the guy,
you're good.
When you get the most powerful guy in the world, is, you know, anything's going to be a letdown. So we love you, and I look forward to seeing you soon because I don't get to see him that much anymore. That's the only problem.
Make him real happy. Buy him one of his ties for Father's
Day. I will do that because he doesn't have enough of those.
Hey, Dad, you have grandkids. That was like his first moment of like autonomy from his father was the sort of passive aggressive announcement that he won't get him a birthday gift. We don't get to see you. And then, of course, Kilmeade is like, you don't understand how to be a proper sycophant for your dad, kid. You buy one of his ties, you moron. That was I don't know why. Maybe I'm just in an empathetic mood right now, but my usual response to that would be to laugh. And my response to that one was just like, oh, man, buddy. What the hell went on in that house? It's like, I remember when I was 17, dad would always, he would show me his penis and he would say it was bigger. And, you know, that was the type of thing. I mean, the guy is just, you know, really down to earth. Smack me in the face. Tell me that I was like a shame to the entire family tree. It was just like the type of thing that made me really confident in business. So thanks, Dad. We were saying that Eric and Tiffany are the Kaiser Soses of the situation. They just stay completely off the radar. Or maybe Tiffany is Trump's side chick. All right. Of course, the show is... The vast majority of the support of the show is by people who become members of the Majority Report. Go to majority.fm/become a member today or click support. How you can do it. And today's show is sponsored by Nutrafol. It's a new, safe, and effective strategy to take control of your hair health. Made with 100% drug-free nutraceutical ingredients, clinically shown to improve thinning hair. It's recommended by over 850 top physicians and some of the top salons in the country. It's been decades since anyone's made meaningful advancements in hair health, but Nutrafol's scientists and researchers have come up with a formula that nourishes the environment, that makes hair happy, and improves hair from within. Better yet, since it's made with medical-grade botanical ingredients, there are no bad side effects or compromises to your overall wellness. In fact, many users report better sleep and digestion. Nutrafol is available in 2 distinct formulas for men and women to suit your specific metabolic needs. Go to Nutrafol.com to learn more. And to get your first month's supply with a subscription for $10, visit NUTRAFOL.com and use promo code majority at during checkout. That's NUTRAFOL.com. Offer code majority. Get your first supply for $10 with a subscription. We will be right back with Jay Cassano on the Majority Report. Welcome back to the Majority Report. I'm Michael Brooks. Joining us now is Jay Cassano. He is an investigative journalist with ReadSludge.com. His new piece, co-authored with Alex Koch, is Pentagon's top official for East Asia-led think tank funded by defense contractors and foreign governments. And basically, it chronicles the story of a relatively little known but major defense player at the Pentagon in terms of formulating military policy for Asia, who has a background that is almost entirely generated by the military-industrial complex and connections with some very provocative thinking with regards to strategy towards China and the broader Pacific region. Jay, let's start real simple. Who is this guy, Randall Shriver, and where? What is his current position, and what's his background?
Yeah, so the story is about Trump's new Assistant Secretary of Defense for Asian and Pacific Security Affairs. The position's a mouthful, but basically it's the top civilian East Asia position in the Pentagon. So it's part of the Secretary of Defense's office. And, you know, one of the key responsibilities of his job is to advise on foreign military sales to East Asia. And, you know, that gets particularly interesting because it turns out that, you know, he used to run this think tank, Project 2049 Institute, that was funded pretty much entirely by defense contractors and East Asian governments. And now he's tasked with advising Secretary of Defense James Mattis on American foreign military sales to those countries like Japan and Taiwan. And, you know, if you just look at the reports that Project 2049 put out in the decade that Randall Shriver was in charge of it, they uniformly supported more weapons being sold to those countries and lifting trade restrictions on those countries while adopting a more aggressive diplomatic posture towards China. You know, it wasn't like there was ever, you know, a particular weapon where they looked at it and thought, oh, you know, maybe Japan shouldn't get this particular weapon. The answer to pretty much any policy question that came up before Project 2049 was always, you know, sell Japan more weapons.
Right. So one of the things that's also interesting about this piece is that you actually really connect the dots between Steve Bannon, actually, this type of very, very old line Washington story of essentially just arms manufacturers obviously having far too much influence in policy writ large. But the way you connect it with Bannon is that, and I'm quoting now from your piece, Steve Bannon told the American Prospect, I'm changing out people at East Asia Defense. I'm getting hawks in. And this is Bannon said this within days before he resigned, actually. And going back to 2016, he said, we're going to have a war with the within the South China Sea in 5 to 10 years, Bannon said in March 2016. And he made it his personal mission to block longtime diplomat Susan Thornton, whom he viewed as too conciliatory from China, to becoming a permanent appointee as Assistant Secretary of State for East Asian Affairs, where she had been serving since March 2017. So connect this sort of – that's the type of thing that, you know, somebody like Bannon gets portrayed as, you know, sort of ultra-hawkish, bizarre, out of the realm of kind of traditional, more establishment defense thinking. Meanwhile, this guy Shriver, who seems pretty synced up with Bannon in terms of a very hawkish posture towards China and a very friendly one to the American arms industry, actually goes back to, you know, his sort of political Sherpa was a guy named Richard Armitage. And this goes back to sort of Bush era defense strategy and consulting networks.
Right. Sorry, I think my connection's breaking up a little bit, but
no, you're fine.
Okay, so yeah, I mean, in terms of Bannon, I mean, it's interesting because we usually think of him in terms of the domestic populism angle, and, you know, it's sort of the China stuff and his protectionism sort of downplayed, and, you know, his connections to Shriver and trying to push out Thornton, you know, some of that was based on other people's reporting, and some of that was based on some deep background interviews I did with people, you know, and I don't know how much Bannon and Shriver themselves are directly connected, but Bannon was clearly at least trying to use Shriver as a wedge to keep Thornton out of the State Department.
Right.
You know, in the end, he failed at keeping her out of the State Department, but Shriver did end up getting the top position in defense. So we kind of ended up with this, you know, more dovish person in state and this more hawkish person in defense, which some people, you know, could say is appropriate. But nonetheless, we have this person who is now deeply tied to the defense industry and foreign governments, who is in charge of foreign military sales to East Asia in the Defense Department.
So take us back to the Richard Armitage angle. Shriver. Richard Armitage served in the Bush administration. He's also a long-term defense official. He has his own consulting group, which Shriver worked at, which you sort of put as a kind of nucleus point behind. Well, first of all, explain their work and what kind of clients they had and what sort of policies they were seeking to promote.
Yeah, I think that's where the story gets really interesting. And I think that's actually, like you said, really the nexus of this whole world is Richard Armitage and his consulting practice. I mean, basically, Armitage was Colin Powell's deputy in the State Department under George W. Bush. And after Colin Powell left, Armitage left a couple months later. And Randall Shriver had been an assistant to Armitage at that time as well. And Shriver left with Armitage, and they went and founded this consulting firm together, Armitage International. And, you know, their clients are not public, but we know a few of them from the financial disclosures that Shriver had to submit when he got nominated for this defense position last year. And so we know that Armitage International is basically, their consulting clients are pretty much entirely defense contractors and foreign governments, just like the funders of Project 2049 Institute. So what happens is they go and they run this consulting firm for a few years. And then after, you know, 3 years, Shriver goes off and founds Project 2049 Institute. And we looked at some tax records, and Shriver was only working at Project 2049 for 20 hours a week. And again, based on those financial disclosures from when he was nominated, we know that he continued to consult for Armitage International until last year. The point being that he was working at the same time at Project 2049 and Armitage International. So these organizations are likely deeply linked, also because there are other employees that we found just from searching on LinkedIn who worked simultaneously at Project 2049 and Armitage International. So basically the idea is, like, Project 2049 kind of presents itself as doing serious objective scholarship, but its funders are the same consulting clients as Armitage International. It shares employees with Armitage International, and it shares an agenda with the consulting clients of Armitage International. So is it really an independent think tank, or is it actually kind of a shadow lobbying firm? And I think that raises some really interesting questions, particularly at this time. You know, Americans are thinking about, you know, Paul Manafort and questions of lobbying ethics and who has to register as a foreign agent. And this is kind of a glaring, I wouldn't even call it a loophole because it's so big. It's just, if you want to fund a think tank, and it's an easy way to buy influence in D.C. You know, we have a great quote from Jeff Hauser, the director of the Revolving Door Project. In our story, he just says, you know, think tanks are sadly smart influence purchasing investments for corporations with business in DC. Registering lobbyists is passe by comparison. And that's, I think, should be really worrying to people, because lobbyists, even though, you know, there are lots of problems with the disclosure regimes and, you know, how much they actually have to report that we can go into, but, you know, the fact is they do have to actually disclose something, whereas, you know, think tanks, consultants, they don't have to disclose anything or nearly as much.
But they could be serving. I mean, they don't have to disclose nearly as much. They could be serving essentially the same function. And from a PR perspective, if people, and, you know, this is not a judgment on anybody. I mean, you shouldn't have to be in the minutia of industries, frankly. I mean, this is kind of like the same thing with Silicon Valley. We need to regulate tech. It's not the burden of everybody to figure out how to personally try to sort of protect their data. They should, but that shouldn't be the aim of policymaking. And I think similarly with DC, you know, people should not have to, I mean, they should. If you are an NPR and you hear, oh, we're interviewing some defense expert from some think tank, the first thing you should do is go and search for who defunds that think tank and what this person's background is, because that will almost certainly illuminate where they're coming from. But, you know, actually, you really should not have to do that. There should be some sense that people sort of, you know, particularly in these roles that are branded as essentially kind of like public advocacy, sort of independent analysis roles, have some, you know, value that isn't just client driven, even though obviously this is, you know, not usually at all the case in DC. And let's just then loop to some of the specifics of it, because I mean, the umbrella of this with Armitage, and again, we can't confirm, you know, specific clients, but it does seem to be, you know, a policy set that advocates for arming up Taiwan as an example, potentially encouraging Japan to.
Well, we can confirm some of Armitage's clients because they were Schreiber's clients.
Right.
So, I mean, one of the important things in this story is that, you know, Schreiber consulted at through Armitage International for the government of Japan.
Right.
And, you know, as soon as he was on day one of taking his new post in the Defense Department, he was given an ethics waiver by, you know, the White House General Counsel that let him work on issues relating to the government of Japan. Normally, under Trump's own ethics rules, you know, draining the swamp and all that good stuff, he would have been barred, I believe, for 2 years from working on anything relating to the government of Japan, because he had a direct financial interest in their well-being, you know, in their agenda recently. Right. And he was just given an ethics waiver on that. And there have been two arms deals, major arms deals to Japan already on his watch. And there's probably, you know, more to come.
Exactly. So, and now let's get to, you know, looping back to 2049. And I'm going to quote now again from you, because this is the sort of, this is the type of kind of public branding and intellectual infrastructure that obviously is, you know, provides the blueprint for everything from talking head appearances to op-eds to, you know, even sort of like longer, you know, PDFs and papers that nobody reads, but that look important and official. So you say that, you know, Schreiber was the founding president of Project 2049, an institute think tank that since launching in 2008 has released reports arguing for a diplomatic approach towards China, for a harder diplomatic approach toward China, and increased military sales in East Asian states with which China has geopolitical disputes. The think tank takes its name from the year in which China purportedly plans to supplant the U.S. as the world's sole global superpower, 100 years after the founding of the People's Republic. Before we move on, I mean, what is the sort of, where does that come from? Is that from China directly? I mean, does China have policy blueprints coming from the People's Liberation Army saying what year they're specifically planning on supplanting us? I mean, I'm not trying to be too glib. It isn't like China doesn't have its own very aggressive and imperial intentions as well. There's no doubt about that. It's not whitewashing China at all. But how does a kind of consensus, which is certainly the worst case of how to view our relations with China, where does this sort of intellectual artillery from that come from? And to what extent, you know, is that sort of influenced obviously by this broader lobbying and arms sale agenda?
Right. I mean, and first just, you know, there is sort of this section of scholarship that focuses on this 2049, you know, I'm year, as a goal of China. I assume there was some kind of proclamation, you know, from the PLA at some point about that. But you know, I'm not a China hand, and I wouldn't call myself a China expert. I'm not even going to say that, you know, all of Project 2049's recommendations are wrong. I think the focus of the story and what's in the public interest is to know about Schreiber's conflicts of interest between his consulting clients and his position at the Defense Department, where he's supposed to be putting the interests of the American people and national security first. But until very recently, he was being paid a heck of a lot of money by defense contractors and foreign governments to help get those defense contractors' weapons sold to those foreign governments. I mean, we don't know how much money he was being paid as a consultant, but we know that, you know, from the think tank, he was making over $100,000 a year for 20 hours a week of work. And it was probably a lot more when he was doing the you know, non-reported consulting work.
What kind of weapons systems and arms are we talking about here?
I mean, you know, so the weapon systems themselves, in the past year or, you know, since Schreiber's taken office, I would say they're not particularly alarming in and of themselves. We're talking about, you know, I focused on one thing in the article, for instance, the Phalanx close-in weapon system, which is a defensive weapon system meant to, you know, protect ships from anti-ship ballistic missiles. And, you know, the question there is not so much like, is Japan going to, you know, use these weapons in an aggressive way? Right. It's more about like the fact that Project 2049 had, for years prior to that, written reports warning about the danger of China's anti-ship ballistic missiles. And then one of the first weapon sales we see as soon as Schreiber takes office is something designed specifically to counter that threat. So it's like there's a very clear relationship between him, the reports that his think tank published, and the weapon sales that are being made. You know, the other weapons were, what do we have? The SM-3 missiles, which were produced by Raytheon and BAE Systems. BAE Systems is a funder of Project 2049, and Raytheon was one of Shriver's Armitage International consulting clients. So, you know, again, it's not necessarily the function of what the missiles are going to do or what the weapons are going to do, but about the conflict of interest in how those sales are done and questions of whether or not he's putting American interests and national security first, because there is the question of, are those sales going to unnecessarily provoke China, and are they actually necessary in the interests of American national security? Because weapon sales, you know, by and large, you know, we don't use most of the weapons that we sell, you know, and that we manufacture right. in the world today, you know, thank God. It's all about kind of this cat and mouse game between what capabilities various countries have and what they could theoretically do to each other, and the power projections that they make over, you know, how much territory they could theoretically, you know, conquer or strike in, or right. all that kind of stuff. So if as soon as you load up a defensive weapon system to counter a threat, then China sees, oh, well, now our anti-ship ballistic missiles aren't quite as effective, and there's the possibility that maybe they see that as a provocation. Maybe they don't. You know, again, I'm not a China expert, but those are the kind of considerations that should be taken into account. And if you have someone that's was until recently on the payroll, effectively, of defense contractors, I think those are valid questions to ask.
Well, definitely. I mean, I do want to get one more example, though, that is a bit specific, because I think it really does illustrate what you're talking about. And this, I don't think, yeah. requires, you know, a sort of, you know, significant expertise in some respects. Of course, this may change, but I want to quote again from the piece. One of the most yeah. recent reports published by Project 2049 focuses on the Senkaku yeah. Islands, a chain of tiny uninhabited islands in the East China Sea that Japan and China both claim. Now, I'll just stipulate here, this is an area of conflict. This is definitely, I mean, certainly symbolic a conflict, and the type of thing that might lead to some, you know, aggressive demonstrations, as an example, certainly in Japan in front of the Chinese embassy. Now, back to you, though. This is also the truth. Despite the fact that the dispute has gone on for decades without any military conflict, the Project 2049 article argues that China is preparing for a, quote-unquote, short and sharp war to take over the island, and recommends a hardline approach to this perceived threat. Policy recommendations from the article include joint Japan-U.S. military exercises near the island and deploying a THAAD missile defense system in Japan, and more drastically, encouraging Japan to establish a permanent presence on the islands. Now, you know, there's a lot to pick apart there, and I think especially in light of North Korea, people are going to have to figure out a way, you know, particularly if we're talking, you know, and I will for this moment, from a real left perspective, of the desire to significantly decrease U.S. military presence across the globe, and also the reality that, you know, this is a region that we don't want to just as easily be defined by a Chinese imperial presence, and there are some security obligations that you can't just bail on overnight. But I think we can all agree that we don't want to be sort of, you know, provocative or aggressive beyond the tricky dynamics that are already in place. Encouraging Japan to occupy those islands is actually precisely the kind of escalation that could lead to this, you know, brief, sharp war. And that really is when you get into the territory of, you know, policy recommendations that are dangerous to the point of self-fulfilling prophecy, and not, you know, we'll get to this later, but you do quote some China hands who say, certainly the Chinese perspective is at the very least a lot more ambiguous than this sort of like monolith monster would suggest. Jay? I think the Randall Shriver cut Jay off. Jay, are you there?
Yeah, sorry, I'm losing the connection a little bit. Oh, okay. Conference.
Oh, I'm not sure what happened. Okay, I don't know if you caught that. Did you get any of that question?
I got, can you repeat the question? I heard most of what you're saying up till the question.
Well, the question would be basically, I mean, that would be an area where we could say very specifically that there is maybe a history. I mean, we have the conflicts of interest, but there might even be actually some real policy advocacy that it would almost be more, you know, not just overreacting to a potential misperception of a future threat, but literally instigating that threat to happen through something as provocative as Japan occupying the Senkaku Islands, as an example.
Islands example was definitely and was one where that's a clear policy recommendation that's just kind of really out of left field and just doesn't make any sense from, like you said, I quoted a real China hand there, and he's someone who is himself, you know, not like a dovish person. He's skeptical of China's actions. It just doesn't, it really doesn't make any sense. And it wasn't like I was cherry picking that article either. It was just at the time we started reporting, it was the most recent report that Project 2049 published. I decided to take a deep dive into it, and just kind of like, holy heck, you know, this is what they're actually advocating for. I went to an expert and said, what do you think of this? Does that make any sense? And he said, it could really initiate a crisis. It doesn't make any sense to do this.
Right. Go ahead.
No, it's all
right. What, I mean, but has there been a response to this so far? I mean, this is somebody who is very, very important, but not, you know, definitely not even amongst sort of wonk circles, a household name. You know, you identified a kind of, you know, a person and a network of influence, which is very important in DC. Arguably, in the long term, you know, policy towards Asia is the sort of, I mean, if we're talking outside of the environment, kind of the fate of the planet. What has the response been?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. You know, like you say, sort of the top level cabinet people get that big, deep profile look, but then these lower level, you know, one, two step down, they don't really get a deep look like this, and that they actually have a lot of power and influence. You know, we haven't gotten a response from the Defense Department. You know, they refused to answer our questions about conflict of interest, which I think says something in and of itself. But we're going to keep sort of, you know, digging into this story and investigating this. So I did publish a follow-up story that takes a closer look at the F-22 deal, which is which is being proposed right now between the U.S. and Japan, where the F-22 is currently banned from being exported. And basically Lockheed Martin wants to offer it to Japan.
Right.
And Shriver is in a position to make that happen. And as you could expect, Project 2049 is at the heart of it, because there's a former Project 2049 and Armitage International employee who is now at Lockheed Martin. You know, Shriver and him, I FOIA'd some emails between them, and they have a very friendly email exchange, and Shriver offers him a job in government. So it's a pretty blatant example of the government defense contractor think tank revolving door situation. And it could have real defense repercussions, because the F-22 is the most advanced air superiority fighter in the world.
Right. Jay Cassano, he's an investigative journalist at readsludge.com. The pieces are co-authored with Alex Koch. They're excellent, really fascinating. And I think, you know, people should be aware not only of how all of these influence networks work, you know, functionally and concretely in Washington. You know, there's a lot of kind of general rhetoric about corruption and conflicts of interest, but actually the specifics of how these things actually work is important. And secondly, I mean, you know, it's a little disturbing, the idea that the future of Asia policy would be just so kind of purely mercantile. So it's great reporting. Jay Cassano, really appreciate your time. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me on, Michael.
Of course. And thanks everybody else, too. You know, I feel like everybody in that conference room was part of this journey. How's the video going? We all right?
It is sorted out.
We're good. Sweet. There was a problem, but now there wasn't a problem.
It's tough stuff, but we've made a deal.
Yeah, I noticed that Matt was there. He was negotiating with the camera. Brendan and Matt were just, they were doing tough negotiations with camera one. Tough negotiations. Camera one was a tough cookie. Folks, become a member of the Majority Report today. It's how the show thrives. There is a link still on the majority.fm blog that I believe we put up for Teacher Lauren's mother to help, you know, get to that goal. She's been basically going through eye operations. She lost her sight. She was just not able to get, I believe, disability. And, you know, both the community, because there was already so much momentum from the TMBS Discord. That was how I actually first heard about it. There was already real momentum on it. So, you know, these community has been coming together and supporting it. So let's keep, you know, let's push all the way through on that. It's really important. You can check out, of course, the Michael Brooks Show, which it would be kind of just inane if you haven't done that yet. Doesn't that seem like crazy if somebody actually has not checked the show out yet? It's been going for like several months now.
Yeah, I have to double check your use of inane.
Inane, like stupid, ridiculous.
Okay. Yeah.
Does that pass your double check, Matt? Inane. I mean, you go into the dictionary now.
Okay.
Does it pass?
It's a bit silly, yeah, I suppose.
No, go ahead, read it.
Silly or stupid.
Okay, stupid not one of the words that I specifically used?
Don't constantly
used?
Badger people with inane questions is the...
Well, don't be silly or stupid or inane and not subscribe to the Michael Brooks Show.
Well, we should do... I think what Matt is being a pedant on is the pronunciation. Am I wrong, Matt?
A little bit, yeah.
Yeah, let's hear that Google Dictionary take.
Inane. What did I say?
Inane.
I name.
Jimi Hendrix is playing in the background, too.
Well, what is going on with that? I want to hear that again. What is that?
That was Jimi Hendrix.
Oh, I thought they literally bedded Jimi Hendrix under it. I was like, that's actually very
inane.
Cool.
Inane.
Inane. All right. Well, gentlemen, it would be inane to not check out the Michael Brooks Show. Full show is available on YouTube. The TMBS YouTube channel, which is going to be a separate channel, is launching next week. So there will be a lot more clippable content, so you can check out shorter versions of the show. And when you become a patron of the Michael Brooks Show at patreon.com/TMBS, you get three extra shows a week now. You get a post game, which is really like, you know, there's comedy sketches and a lot of others and, you know, calls and IMs and stuff that you wouldn't get otherwise, obviously. Then there's the Woke Bros show with Waz and I, and then there's the Deep Dive Illicit Histories and Idea Primers History. This Sunday, just recorded an interview with a member of the Belgian Workers' Party and an advisor to the European Left Group on the future of Eurozone politics and what an authentic left would look like in Europe, following up off of the conversation with Mark Blythe on the Eurozone. So check it out, and definitely... You know, if you've already checked out a little bit, then go get the whole thing at patreon.com/TMBS. What is going on with Literary Hangover, Matt Leck?
We're doing releasing Rip Van Winkle on Saturday. And
that's fascinating. Like, I don't know, like Rip Van Winkle. I know this, like
going to sleep through a revolution sort of thing.
Yeah, but I don't know the story at all. Like, when was that written? What is the? That's fascinating.
1819 is written by Washington Irving in a sort of collection of short stories that he also did Sleepy Hollow in. Okay. It's sort of a take from a folktale, a German folktale, like, I forget what the thing is called, but he's like a goat herd and he falls asleep. But Washington Irving adds a few elements like the you sleep through a revolution and you wake up and, you know, it was, you know, King George and then it's George Washington and all that stuff. And it also, he really doesn't like his wife. Like
even after he wakes up, he's like, oh, I'm still married.
He's literally like, he's afraid to say who he is until he finds out that his wife is dead. That's literally true.
Wow.
So yeah, right from the beginning, the first American story about hating your wife.
My wife. I want to know if my wife is dead. Before I wake up. How can I listened to the first episode of Literary. It's cool. I love that it's like really something. It's different. Which is, you know, it's,
yeah, I think,
but
so.
it's like it's the perfect, like, within the zone of this whole ecosystem you're in, but then like the different way
you
to
can
get
see where
there.
The ingredients came from.
Yeah, exactly. But getting there through a different place. So, what are all the ways that people find that?
iTunes. It's on Google Play Music now too, actually, and should be on Stitcher in the next 24 hours.
Sweet.
And Patreon.com/literaryhangover if you want to support me.
Sweet. And then, of course, check out The Antifada, Jamie and Sean's show as well. That's patreon.com/antifada or
The Antifada.
The Antifada. 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920. IMs are open. Calls are on. See you in the fun half.